Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we interface weird and wonderful science with your brain. I'm Ian Wolfe. This week you'll hear interviews about solar-powered racing cars, suicide modelling, and virtual pain management. But first up, here's the news. Climate catastrophe. 28 people have died and 2,000 homes have burned down as fires rage out of control over 11 million hectares, an area bigger than Portugal. Fires in New South Wales and Victoria have joined up to become superfires, and these joined to become one giant megafire that is so hot over such a wide area that it creates its own weather systems, from dry lightning that spreads fires many kilometres away to fire tornadoes. Cities are smothered in smoke. Over 1 billion animals have died in the bushfires in New South Wales and Victoria since they started in the Australian winter in August 2019. The number was calculated by Professor Chris Dickman, an expert on Australian biodiversity at the University of Sydney. Professor Dickman calculated the number by using a 2007 report for the Worldwide Fund for Nature on the impacts of land clearing on Australian wildlife in New South Wales. The authors of that report obtained estimates of mammal, bird and reptile population density in New South Wales and then multiplied the density estimates by the areas of vegetation approved to be cleared. Estimates of density were obtained from published studies of these animal groups in New South Wales and from studies carried out in other parts of Australia with similar habitats. The data includes mammals, birds and reptiles, but not bats, frogs, insects or other invertebrates because they didn't have that data. This means the number of animals killed will be larger than the billion estimated. Some 34 species and subspecies of native mammals have become extinct in Australia over the last 200 years, the highest rate of loss for any region in the world. There are concerns that this enormous fire will drive some species to extinction. The original report covered the period from 1998 to 2005, where the New South Wales state government approved 640,000 hectares of forest to be cleared, resulting in the deaths of 104 million native reptiles, mammals and birds. 1 billion animals killed in less than 5 months by the fires is a lot worse than the total lost to development in New South Wales over 7 years. Some of the forests have evolved with fire and will make some recovery, but our rainforests that haven't burned in millions of years will never recover. Professor Dickman told National Public Radio in America that prior research shows that animals that survived the fires in the first instance by fleeing or going underground will return or re-emerge into areas that don't have the food and water to support them. Others will be killed by introduced predators such as feral cats and red foxes. Even for those animals able to flee to unburned areas, they will rarely be able to successfully compete with the animals that are already living there, and so they'll die within a short time. It's January 2020, early in what used to be the fire season in Australia before the climate changed, so we expect more months of extreme heat and dryness ahead. Sydney is projected to run out of water within 2 years. The New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service have started dropping food, tons of mostly sweet potatoes and carrots, for endangered brush-tailed rock wallabies across the state. Biologists report that wombats in fire-affected areas allowed many small animals to take shelter with them from the fire in their deep burrows. The Australian government have been slow to respond to offers of help to fight the fires from around the world, and instead have relied on volunteers working until they drop. Funds for fire trucks, planes, and firefighters were cut deeply last year at the federal and state level. The federal government has approved a taxable $6,000 payment for firefighters who still have a job to go back to. The Australian government has failed to declare a national emergency with the extra resources such a declaration would unlock, and has refused to offer any help to states unless they explicitly ask for it first. Volunteer firefighters who have lost their jobs are being cut off from welfare payments because they aren't actively looking for paying work while they're fighting fires. The Prime Minister said that firefighters don't want to be paid because they want to be there at the fires. This statement was loudly denied by the volunteer firefighters themselves. Volunteer firefighters who have lost their jobs are only exempt from searching for paying work during official states of emergency. The New South Wales state government declared a 7-day state of emergency in early December, and then another 7 days in the first week of January. All over Australia and around the world, people are coming to the realisation that, for whatever reason, the Australian government has not been doing all it can. You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. And now from CBIT, here's some short interviews with researchers from Western Sydney University. Solar-powered racing. Georgie Georgias is the strategy officer of the Western Sydney Solar Team. I began by asking him to tell me about his team's solar-powered racing car.
We're not allowed to say racing technically.
Oh, all right.
But it's a Challenger car for the Bridgestone World Solar Challenge. So it's every 2 years in Australia. And last year we started competing in America. So we're planning to do that next year as well. So the car right in front of us is Unlimited 3.0. So we developed that this year. It's a whole new redesign compared to our previous cars. So it's a monohull, and our previous cars were a catamaran style. So basically they look like boats, to be honest with you. So the catamaran's the river cat you might see on Parramatta River. And the monohull is more like a speedboat sort of looking thing.
And can you tell me about the Solar Challenge?
So the Bridgestone World Solar Challenge is a 3,022 kilometre challenge from Darwin to Adelaide. It's every 2 years. And you get everyone from all over the world. You've got America, Canada, all over Europe, Asia as well. So it's a big event.
And how fast can you go such a huge distance?
So our top speed of the car is 130 kilometres an hour. It depends on the team and your weather, but anywhere from 60 to the speed limit for some teams is average though. 100 kilometres, 90 kilometres. So pretty fast car. It's not slow like you might think.
Well, there's a lot of desert between those two cities. Were there many cloudy days?
Fortunately, this year, there was no cloudy days. If we go back 2 years ago, there was a big storm in central Australia. It covered the whole distance. This time, though, there was very strong winds, which most teams had problems with. So you're looking at 80-kilometre gusts, like 60-kilometre constant winds. It was pretty bad wind this year.
So you can't just go for the lightest car with the fastest motor because you could get blown over.
Well, actually for us, the issue wasn't it was light. So we are the lightest car, so 116 kilos. But the issue with us is our ray opened up, so it was a bit like a sailboat. So it wasn't because it was light, it was just the aerodynamic effects of the car sort of changed. So the predominant force then became sailing boat. So other teams rolled over that weren't as light, but they still rolled over. So it was more of a 80 kilometre gust sort of thing. In reality, we're in the other vehicles behind us and they were being pushed around too, so it wasn't nice wind at the time.
How many solar cells are on the car?
There's 820-ish cells on the car.
And you got battery storage as well.
Yeah, so everyone gets 20 kilos of lithium ion battery, but they can choose the type. In our case, we've chosen lithium ion, so we get about 5 kilowatt hours worth.
And when was the last one of these challenges held?
Funny you ask that. We came back last Tuesday from the race, but the race was the previous week from Sunday to Saturday, so quite recent.
And which cars won?
So for the, I think it's their first time, but Agoria from Belgium won. So they were right behind Vattenfall, so they're coming first, and then their battery caught on fire with Agoria 2 minutes behind them. So then Agoria got the win. So that was a first for them, and they were very happy. And as bad as it sounds, most teams are happy that Vattenfall didn't win again. So it was a good race this year, actually, quite eventful.
And are you a student?
Yeah, I'm a student at Western Sydney.
And what are you studying?
I study civil engineering.
And what got you interested in the solar challenge?
So back when I joined, there was an email sent out, I assume, to every student. It was basically sustainable house or solar car. I went to the, I guess, intro night, orientation night, or I don't know, some sort of night. And they both teams showed what they had to offer, I guess. And I was leaning more towards the house because obviously I was doing civil engineering. I thought, oh, that's probably more my alley. But the car was far cooler and more interesting, and it had more to offer, to be honest, because I wouldn't learn what I've learned in the car in my course. So I've learned terms here and learned about stuff that I normally wouldn't learn about. In the end, no regrets joining it.
Will you keep on for the rest of your degree?
This is actually already my second race. So I've been here for 3.5 years now. So I should probably finish my degree, but we'll see. I wasn't planning to be here for the last race. You never know about next time.
Maybe they'll hire you on after you graduate.
Also, this is all volunteer, so no one gets paid. So there's no real hiring. So we do get previous members to come, I guess, mentor others. So I guess that's a possibility, but we'll see.
So do you think you'll go more in this sort of area rather than the houses when you graduate?
We'll see about that. So I'm studying geomatics. So that's remote sensing, positioning, that sort of stuff. So there is a bit of knowledge that I learned in there that I have applied to the car, but it's not what you can see. It's software and planning and that sort of stuff. So it's not, my degree is not completely useless on the car, but at the same time, I guess compared to like mechanical engineering or electrical engineering, it can't be fully applied to the car. It's a beautiful car, to be honest. We're all quite proud of it.
Well, Georgie, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ian.
That was Georgie Georgius from the Western Sydney University with his team's solar-powered racing car. And now the sensitive subject of suicide prevention. Mark Hefnung is an adjunct professor at the School of Computer Engineering and Mathematics at the Western Sydney University. I began by asking Mark, you're looking into data analysis and modelling of people at risk of suicide?
Yes, we've engaged in a project for a while now with various public health networks looking at trying to put a logical dimension and a mathematically consistent dimension to what is a very emotional problem and a very serious problem in the community.
And what sort of information are you putting into the model?
Well, we basically look at how often people will attempt to suicide and what's likely to drive them to do that and the completion rate, which is unfortunately about 10%. And what this sort of somewhat clinical analysis allows us to do is say, well, you know, we, in the general community, you can't pick people who are going to otherwise suicide, but the people that have attempted, at least you know who they are because they turn up in hospital, and you can target services towards them.
And what sort of people do you have providing information on how the model should be built?
Well, basically what we try and do is make it as inclusive as we can. We have like policemen that tell us about what they call random events. We have clinicians, obviously GPs, who see a lot of people and deal with them. We have people from ED who have seen people after they've survived. And then we see caseworkers and psychologists and social workers that deal with people both before and after.
And you include people who've attempted suicide before?
Yes, that's always sort of a touchy part of it. They call it people with lived experience, and they obviously usually get quite emotional when they're reliving what's happened to them. But there are some that can be dispassionate about it when they're describing, I mean, there's an ABC show about You Can't Ask That, that had people that had attempted it. And so you can ask that, and you need to actually sort of get a better understanding of the problem.
So you get all this data going into your model. And then does the model give you a sense of how different policies will affect people?
That's the whole point of it. In this particular modelling looks at the population in aggregate, so we can't prescribe for any one particular person what's likely to happen. That's another kind of modelling called agent-based modelling. What we're doing is called system dynamics, which looks at aggregate averages, so that we say if we can reduce the rate at which people attempt suicide, then this will be the impact, or if we can reduce the rate at which they actually die from suicide, then this will be the impact, because you can't die more than once. So, but it's looking at how these trends play out over time, because you can sort of put a dent in it, but you can't really control it. I guess the interesting thing in how severe this problem is, in about the 1960s, there were roughly 25 deaths per 100,000 from car accidents. That's now down to 4.5, but has gone up to about 5 with people texting, whereas in the same time, suicides have gone from 10 to 12.5 per 100,000 per annum. So it's actually getting a little bit worse.
And who is it that is paying attention to the outcomes of these models? Who are the customers that are asking for the information?
Basically, it's the PHNs, public health networks, who have to put together packages of where they like to get their biggest bang for their buck. And so while we can't specify exactly how many lives will be saved, we can say things that if you spend a lot of money on GP training, for instance, before you put in place the downstream services that those people will need, you will make things worse, likely make things worse for a little while. So it's the timing of implementation is equally as important as what you actually do.
It seems like you should be also getting people paying attention on both sides of all sorts of political issues that can affect vulnerable people. Things like Centrelink policy or asylum seeker policy and things that can lead to suicides.
Yes, so there's a whole range of reasons why people ideate, and it's trying to get the best understanding. I mean, particularly the sort of Aboriginal communities have a very high suicide rate, and that's something that we're particularly interested in, and have sort of sub-models that look at that in particular.
Do you have anyone in the federal government looking at your models?
Yes, they've recently been down to make some submissions in Canberra to sort of Greg Hunt and a few other people. So Ian Hickey is a great advocate for the work we're doing, so it's best to let him do it. You don't have a dog and bark yourself, so we let him do that talking.
It just seems like there's so many government policies that can adversely affect people that are subject to depression and all the other negative emotions that can lead to this sort of thinking. Shouldn't this be part of all of the policy making that could potentially harm people?
Well, we would advocate that sort of thing, but you can't boil the ocean. We can't attack everything at once. So we do things that are of particular interest to us and where we think we can make a difference. I'd just like to encourage more people to have a bit of a look at system dynamics as a methodology for just a slightly different way of looking at things. I'm an engineer, and we have a saying in the engineering field, if the only tool you've got is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So every now and then you need a Phillips head screwdriver, and we would say, we're the Phillips head screwdriver.
Well, Mark, thank you very much.
Okay, my pleasure.
That was Mark Hefnung from Western Sydney University talking about data analysis and modelling of people at risk of suicide. If this story has raised upsetting issues for you, in Australia, you can call the SANE helpline on 1800 18 7263, or SANE, S-A-N-E, or Lifeline on 131114, or the Suicide Callback Service 1300 659 467. In the US, you could call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline 1800 273 8255. Virtual pain management. Senior lecturer Anton Bogdanovich teaches video games development and programming at Western Sydney University. I began by asking him, is this a virtual reality game for pain relief?
Yeah, so this exhibit is a project funded by Sony. It's a collaborative work between Western Sydney University and Liverpool Hospital. We also work with a psychologist from Melbourne, so it's quite a team.
And so what's the idea here? So you've got people in extreme pain, from injury or illness, and they put on a headset?
It's not necessarily extreme pain. What we are looking after is chronic pain. So virtual reality and gaming and many other things can be used as a distraction therapy. But we try to go a step further from distraction. We try to achieve a long-lasting effect. So it's more of a training solution, and it's a psychological training solution.
And so what do they see in the virtual reality?
So what we're trying to do is we try to replicate a psychological intervention, a small part of it, because it's just a prototype. And what they see basically is what a patient is likely to construct in their head. So imaginary world as a result of speaking to a psychologist. So they will be wearing a headset and they will be listening to the voice of the psychologist, but all the experience will be visualized there and there will be instructions on how to interact with it.
And so what will their pain be like, a character in the virtual reality?
Yeah, that's right. So you have this character that is initially doesn't look too bad. It's just this red spiky thing. But then initially you start with being introduced to your pain. And if you have chronic pain, that we introduce you to the metaphor that the pain is going to follow you around. And initially your first reaction is to be aggressive towards it. And we even have a little level in this game, if you like to call it a game, where you are just releasing your aggression, you're punching the pain. And in the process of that, you will see that the pain just grows bigger and angrier. And it's really not constructive. This is what you learn from this experience, to fight your pain. What you have to learn is to coexist with it, where it doesn't bother you so much. So through the process of this interaction, you learn how to do it. So we're not promising that the pain will go away, but it will not be as aggressive, right? And this is a replica of the actual treatment, so it works. The psychologist is practicing it on a daily basis, and the whole idea is that your pain will drop substantially. As I said, it's not going to go away, but it will not feel as invasive and overwhelming.
So getting angry with your pain isn't really helpful?
No, it's not. As far as I'm, as I said to you before, I'm not really a doctor. As of medical doctor, I'm a computer scientist, but my understanding of working with the doctors is that, it's not really constructive to be aggressive and angry and upset about your pain. You just have to learn how to coexist and how to not have it taking control over your life.
And this has been programmed here at the university?
Yeah, so we work with a startup company that did a lot of art for us and some programming. But we had, I was working on it as well because the funding was rather small, so I had to put some of my free time. And there was a student that helped us as well to finish off the prototype. We will be doing the first trials in January in Liverpool Hospital with some cancer patients to see whether we can achieve the same effect as speaking with a psychologist. And then we are trying to get more funding to get the entire treatment converted into it. This is the plan.
And what language would you have used to program this?
So we build it in Unity, and the language, programming language for the scripts would be C#.
And Unity is used for lots of games?
Yes, that Unity is used for lots of games, for lots of serious games as well, for a lot of research. It's an easy platform to use, but so is Unreal and many others. Yeah. We also build in, I was personally quite skeptical about it, but I spoke to many people, including some pain sufferers, and these psychological treatments really work. So I spoke to a guy today even that basically was struggling with his knee pain and was about to get knee replacement until he spoke to a psychologist. And eventually, over time, you just need to be focused, you just need to do those little exercises. But over time, you just know how to behave so that the pain is not as aggressive and doesn't bother you too much, and it seems to work. So we really hope that we can replicate this experience in virtual reality, and you don't have to travel and pay a psychologist. You can just pull out a headset and just do it at your own home environment.
I saw something like this being used years ago for burns victims, where the theory of the time was that if you give all of your attention to a really immersive virtual reality, you don't have much left over to experience the pain.
Yeah, so this is what is called the distraction therapy, where there are all these ideas from psychology, like flow is one of them. I try to use it in my teaching. This is a lot of it has been covered in addiction, why people are addicted to game. So you just have this experience that is so overwhelming that you don't have any other sensory input for anything else, right? And you're just so absorbed in this experience that nothing else seems to matter. And these are the conditions where you would forget about your pain, sometimes entirely forget that it exists, but then you take off your headset and the pain is back. So what we want is we want to train you. And there are many techniques. We're just scratching the surface here of this whole intervention. We're building another module that is called progressive muscle relaxation. And briefly, my understanding of the idea is that if you have a pain in some region, what makes it much worse is the muscles being tense, and you can't directly relax it without external help. But what you can do is you can relax all the muscles around it, and those muscles at the pain region will also relax. So you do those exercises where you start with your face and then with your hand and say you have lower back pain. By gradually releasing all the muscles around it, you will have less pain in your lower back. And we are currently building it. We're not quite ready for CBIT to present, but we will have it ready before January for trials in Liverpool Hospital, and we will turn it into a game. So the big problem with people trying to do it at their home is how to motivate them to do it, because it's quite a lengthy process. And we try to motivate them to do it by similar mechanics as what motivates people to play video games.
Well, Anton, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please do send me an email with a question I can answer on the show. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter at Ian Wolf. The news music was Rhinos Theme by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 26 stations on the Community Radio Network, including 2RBM in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2NVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border Districts of Victoria and South Australia, and 7LTN City Park Radio in Launceston, Tasmania. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station, and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com. And check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 1,000 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. If you enjoyed this show, you can explore nearly 1,000 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography, collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.